Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, will the morning call of Allentown be decimated by a New York hedge fund? And we'll get the latest on the Philadelphia Flower Show, which is being held outside across 15 acres of FDR Park. But first, New Jersey's primary election is tomorrow. Democratic and Republican Party candidates will be chosen to run in the general election this fall. All 40 seats in the state Senate are up for election this year, as are all 80 seats in the Assembly. And there are a few contests of note, but the marquee race in the 2020 primary is likely that for the Republican nominee for governor of New Jersey, the person who will face incumbent Phil Murphy in November. Murphy is unopposed in the Democratic primary, and on the GOP side, the race is seen by many as a referendum on former President Trump, who still enjoys strong support among a sizable number of New Jersey's Republican voters. Candidates vying for the nomination are embracing Trump to varying degrees, some wholeheartedly, while others rather gingerly. Joining us now with analysis on this and more is Bridget Harrison, professor of political science and law at Montclair State University. And good to have you back with us again, Bridget.
Good morning, Mary. Good to be back.
So there are four Republicans vying for the GOP gubernatorial nomination. Let's begin with the two who are in the forefront, former state assemblyman Jack Cittarelli and engineer Hirsch Singh. Cittarelli is considered to be the front runner. Bridget, tell us a bit more about them.
So Jack Cittarelli should be familiar to many voters. He ran against Kim Guadagno in the primary election of 2017 and performed pretty well. He talked out against Governor Christie. In 2017, he managed to get 31% of the vote, which was rather impressive. He's known as a moderate politically. And it's interesting because having two Trump-favored candidates in this race has meant that he really has had to track a little bit right and embrace President Trump perhaps a little more than he had in the past and also more than he wanted to. You mentioned Hirsch Singh, an engineer, and he's really an interesting person. He's an engineer. He lives with his parents in Atlantic County. He is a perennial candidate on the ballot, and frankly, not many people took him too seriously until some of the polls started indicating that that pro-Trump faction, which is going to be very important in this GOP primary because it'll be a low turnout election. He actually was, in competition with Jack Cittarelli, who has the backing of the 21 GOP party leaders. So it was surprising that Singh was performing so well.
Yeah, Cittarelli has much more in the war chest. And as you mentioned, he is the person who's got the backing of the Republican Party establishment. There are a lot of people in red areas in New Jersey who apparently still believe the fraudulent claim that Donald Trump won the election in 2020, Hirsch Singh is four square behind this. Is Singh's position as with his support behind Donald Trump, is this something that potentially could lead to a Singh surge in the primary tomorrow? Do you see this happening?
It could happen. The thing that makes it a little bit less likely to happen is that there is another candidate, a former pastor by the name of Phil Rizzo. And Rizzo has managed to garner a decent amount of campaign contributions. In fact, if you count number of donors, he has raised more money from donors than Hirsch Singh has. Hirsch Singh has primarily funded his own campaign. And the fact that Rizzo is also a Trump supporter and has embraced some of the theories that you're suggesting means that there's a likelihood that they're going to split some of that Trump faction vote. And that's good news for Cittarelli. If he were going head-to-head against one person who was a Trump supporter, chances are that this would be much more competitive than it is. There actually have been allegations that, one of these individuals is a pawn of the Democrat, again, unsubstantiated. Mm-hmm. But the fact that both of them haven't embraced the Trump agenda means that they're splitting some of that Trump support.
And again, Jack Cittarelli has danced around his relationship with former President Trump. In 2015, he called candidate Trump a charlatan, but he has since seemed to embrace him, albeit carefully. Should he win the nomination, does he need to hold Donald Trump at arm's length to have a chance against incumbent Democrat Phil Murphy in the fall?
Absolutely. And I mean, if the election were held tomorrow, I don't think that Governor Murphy would have a whole lot of problems here, right? This is a relatively blue state, particularly when it comes to recent statewide elections. But also, the governor's approval ratings are quite high. The campaign issue that Cittarelli has been running on has been Governor Murphy's handling of the pandemic, yeah, which most New Jersey voters give him 5 stars for. Cittarelli has kind of complained that the governor hasn't opened the state quickly enough. He's tried to attract the support of small business owners in particular. But, you know, given the realities of the state of New Jersey, this is Phil Murphy's race to lose, and no one right now sees him doing that. But Cittarelli will have to keep in a general election. Cittarelli is going to have to recenter himself. These candidates who are supporting Trump in the primary, or who are Trump supporters, really pushed him to the right, further right than he's been in his, you know, very long political career. And he's going to have to move back to attract the general election voter that is much more liberal than his GOP constituent that he's going after tomorrow.
So, Bridget, worth noting, as WHYY's Kenny Burns reminded us recently, New Jerseyans have elected and reelected several Republican governors in recent memory, but no Democrat has won reelection to the governor's office in New Jersey since 1977. So you think Phil Murphy has a shot to change this narrative in the fall? Do we have you there? We might have lost Bridget Harrison.
Oh, you know, when we look at this,
I think we've got you there, Bridget. You with us here on the regional roundup? I think our connection might be fading in and out.
Mary, can you hear me?
I can. We might be having some difficulties with our connection. So I guess my question is, again, no Democrat has won re-election to the governor's office in decades, 1977 specifically. So it seems, you know, from what you were saying earlier, that Phil Murphy will likely be the first to do this in decades in the fall. That's your sense.
Okay. That is.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Higher approval ratings than any governor in his. Yeah, I mean, that is my sense. He has much higher approval ratings than any sitting governor in this position, other than Chris Christie, but certainly any Democrat. And so, you know, again, this is his race to lose. He is very popular and has emerged from the pandemic with high levels of approval ratings from most New Jerseyans.
Okay, let's take a look at some other races that are happening tomorrow. All seats in the legislature up for election this year. That's in New Jersey, of course. There is at least one race of note, a contested primary in the 37th District. A longtime state senator, Loretta Weinberg, is retiring in January. Bridget Harrison, what has Weinberg brought to the table over the years?
She has been a remarkable stalwart of the Democratic Party. Really, many people view her as kind of the conscience of the Democratic Party in the state. And she has mentored an incredible number of important political leaders throughout the state, particularly women. And she has been, for many years, a tireless and vocal advocate for particularly policies that support women. I always give the example, when I was having my children back in the day, and many people remember this, there was the possibility that you would go into a hospital and give birth and be discharged sometimes within 12 hours.
Sure.
And the reason that that no longer happens is the legislation that Loretta Weinberg sponsored. So she has really left her mark on the state of New Jersey, both in terms of the policies that she's supported, but also in the mentorship that she's provided to many generations of policymakers who are succeeding her.
And just briefly, there is a bitter primary battle underway for the nomination, the Democratic nomination, to succeed her. Tell us about that.
There is indeed. And both assembly members, so in New Jersey, each district has one state senator and two assembly members. And both of the assembly members who have served alongside her, she initially did not back any candidate, have decided that they both like to run for the seat. And that's Gordon Johnson and Valerie Huddle. And right now, it looks like Johnson does have the upper hand. He has managed to win the support of the county party chairs and county committees, which are incredibly important in the state of New Jersey. He'll be running on the line and has the endorsement of Governor Phil Murphy, and has a bit of a fundraising advantage when you count all of the super PACs and other political action committees that are funding both advertising and GOTV efforts. And so it looks like Johnson has a large swath of support. Huddle, on the other hand, has managed to attract the support of many of the progressive organizations, not just within her district, but throughout the state. So in some ways, this is a bit of a proxy war between the standard bearers of the party. Remember, Huddle has been one of those until she wasn't, and the progressives. But it really is a kind of mini proxy war, if you will.
All right, we'll see what happens tomorrow. There's a federal lawsuit regarding ballot construction. Recently, voting rights groups in New Jersey asked to sign on. And the basic issue, as I understand it, is this. The way a ballot is constructed can give certain candidates an edge. For instance, in New Jersey, candidates who are endorsed by county committees or political committees are bracketed together in a row or a column. Bridget Harrison, is there some truth here that this layout favors certain candidates?
Oh, it certainly does favor candidates. It favors the candidates that have won the endorsement of democratically elected county committee members and party chairs who head those committees. And, you know, there's a great deal of kind of concern about this. But one thing I would say is that some of the research indicates that when you replace the leaders of political parties or those county committees, one thing that emerges as an important indicator is money. And so then candidates who are particularly well-funded, who may not have been vetted by county parties, emerge as the most serious competitors rather than candidates who have had to go through the process of trying to earn the support of county committee members. And that race up in the 37th district in Bergen County is a good example of that, right? That Johnson had good relationships with the Bergen County Committee members and thus was able to win their endorsement and support.
Okay, just a brief note as we wrap up. All regular polling places are open tomorrow in New Jersey. If you've requested a mail-in ballot, you should have gotten one. There are drop boxes available as well. Bridget Harrison, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mary.
Bridget Harrison is professor of political science and law at Montclair State University. And up next on the Roundup, we hear from David Boardman, who is chair of the Lemfest Institute for Journalism. We'll be talking about vulture capitalism and vulnerable newspapers like The Morning Call of Allentown. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It is a precarious time for local newspapers across the country, vulnerable as they face a loss of readership and advertising dollars while attempting to transition to digital platforms. Many become easy pickings for vulture capitalists, investment firms which purchase troubled companies and then take aggressive and often destructive action to boost profits. The venerable Morning Call of Allentown now finds itself in such a situation. The Morning Call is owned by Tribune Publishing, which was recently acquired by Alden Global Capital, a New York investment firm whose MO has been to move in and decimate the newspapers it acquires by making deep cuts in staff while liquidating capital assets. There's a grassroots effort to find and build local ownership for the morning call. But what are the odds this will succeed? And are there other ways struggling local papers can fend off opportunistic investment firms and preserve community-based journalism? David Boardman is Dean of Temple University's Klein College of Media and Communication and also Chair of the Lenvest Institute for Journalism. And David, it is so good to have you with us on the Regional Roundup.
Thank you, Mary. It's great to be here.
When you heard the news that Alden Global Capital had fully acquired Tribune Publishing, what went through your mind?
Well, it's really just tragic. Unfortunately, I have to say it wasn't surprising because they are incredibly aggressive and they've been stunningly successful at swallowing up newspaper properties. They are now the second largest newspaper publisher in the United States, second only to the Gannett Corporation. And they operate under several names, Media News and Digital First Media. They own newspapers all over the country. People would be probably surprised because they haven't heard of Alden Global Capital, but they own the Chicago Tribune, the Denver Post, the Boston Herald, the San Jose Mercury News, the Orange County Register, the New York Daily News, the Baltimore Sun, and on and on. In Pennsylvania here, they own now seven daily newspapers. There's been a lot of attention, of course, around the Morning Call, which really has a great, great local newspaper. But so was the Reading Eagle, which they also own. They own the Daily Local News in Westchester, the Delaware County Times, Pottstown Mercury, the Lansdale Reporter, and the Norristown Times Herald, along with more than 40 weekly newspapers and magazines in Pennsylvania. So most of your listeners are touched one way or another by this company.
Mind-boggling. So was the Reading Eagle? So what are the changes you've observed? I mean, what happened to the Reading Eagle briefly when Alden stepped
in? Well, they haven't owned them for long, but in that time, they came in and just decimated the staff. I mean, this is what they do. They come in where there is real estate to be sold. That's usually one of their first moves is they will. Many of these newspapers are located in valuable real estate in downtown neighborhoods because that was the tradition of newspapers. And one of the first things they do is to sell the real estate. In the case of Allentown, the Morning Call building was already sold by a previous owner. So that won't be the case. But they sell the real estate. Then they generally offer a voluntary buyout for a short period of time. And then they come in and just start laying people off. Yeah. The size of these new staffs are reduced dramatically over time. Probably the most dramatic example of this, I think, and it's also in many ways maybe the most important nationally, is the Mercury News in San Jose. Mm-hmm. Is there a more important region of the country than Silicon Valley in terms of power, maybe equal to New York and Washington? At its peak, the Mercury News had more than 650 journalists covering this center of power. Now they have fewer than 50. And that's largely thanks to Alden.
So, what is your observation about the quality of what is being produced at the Mercury News?
Yeah, I mean, the quality of all of these newspapers, it's really sad. It's tragic because what Alden does is you can't cover local news if you don't have local journalists. And so what they largely do is fill these newspapers with wire copy from the Associated Press or other prepackaged copy. They have very shallow local news coverage. And the implications and impacts of that, we just can't overstate in terms of the impact on our society. There have been study after study that show with a decline of local newspapers and the local news for which they are still the primary source, we see less citizen participation in voting, less competitive elections, weaker municipal finances in terms of the bond ratings of these communities, much more government corruption. And interestingly enough, and this is a new study, we even see more partisanship, because if people aren't exposed to the local issues and the complexities and nuances of their local issues around taxes and sewer levies and education. And instead, all the news they get is the news from CNN or Fox or MSNBC. They tend to migrate to these polar positions of partisanship, and it breaks down our communities.
So let's talk about what you see happening at the Morning Call, which right now, the newspaper, according to the Morning Call itself, payroll at the newspaper once numbered more than 1,000. It's down to about 100, which I believe includes 45 journalists. I mean, how much smaller can it get before you can actually call it a newspaper?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, Mary. And, you know, the people who are there, I can tell the community of Allentown, those people are incredibly committed journalists. I mean, they have been, they've endured round after round of reduction and threat. And if you're still hanging in there at a place like the Morning Call, you love journalism and you love your community. So what they need more than anything right now is for the community to continue to support the newspaper. But at the same time, I think I know that the members of that newsroom are looking at alternatives. They had hoped to find local people who would support, who would purchase the newspaper, who would purchase it from Tribune, apart from Alden. I think even now they're hopeful that somebody might come along and make Alden an offer they can't refuse. Personally, I'm not sure that's likely.
And why not?
What they may want, because Alden, there's still a lot of money to be made in stripping down the newspaper for its parts. Hmm. What Alden does is it just rides it out. The advertising that's in the paper, a lot of that is legal advertising that local governments are mandated to do. There is a certain sort of advertising that will stay in that newspaper for a long time to come. I think the most likely route for revitalization of journalism in a place like Allentown may lie in something similar to what's happened here in Philadelphia, where the emergence of a nonprofit answer, people who are really interested in the community, in the good work and the benevolence that a newspaper and good journalism represents. Can that happen through the Morning Call? Perhaps, but it may need to happen in a new way. Here in Philadelphia, you know, we were very much blessed with the vision of Jerry Lentfest, yes, who was the last private owner of the Enquirer. And he did something unique and remarkable, which is he created a nonprofit and donated the newspaper to that nonprofit. That is the now called the Lentfest Institute for Journalism. And as you know, its sole mission is to support public interest journalism in this community and to find a viable future for local news now and into the future, both here in Philadelphia and elsewhere.
Well, I'm just going to say Jerry Lentfest had the wherewithal to do this. How many Jerry Lentfests are there across the country? I mean, have you heard of other movements like this to really push back against vulture capitalists like Alden Global?
Yeah, there are two important things that are happening, Mary. One is that there is a movement around the country, a really vibrant movement that is, for the first time, framing local news as a community asset in the same way that libraries and museums and public schools are. And we at Lentfest actually are in the center of that. We've helped create something called the News Philanthropy Network. And at both nonprofit organizations and even at private newspapers like the Seattle Times, where I used to work, there is a growing effort to get philanthropic support for news organizations, much like your own organization does with public media. We're seeing, I think, in Baltimore, there's a gentleman named Stuart Bynum who attempted to buy the Baltimore Sun. from the Tribune and Alden. That was unsuccessful, but I think we could see an effort there emerge that would perhaps compete with the Baltimore Sun. We'll see. And I think an effort like that might get a lot of support from the community. Yeah. The other thing that's really important that the public should know about and support is there is a bipartisan effort in Congress to look at a variety of actions that would help address this crisis in local news.
That was my next question, because Senator Casey has expressed concern. Bob Casey's expressed concern about what's happening to the morning call. So there is nothing in place yet to push back against vulture capitalists when they target local journalism.
No, there really isn't. There's nothing that stands in the way of this now, and so. There's an awakening in Congress from members of both parties, actually, to look at what can be done to address this crisis. And those remedies could include tax credits that would encourage people to buy subscriptions to papers, tax credits that would encourage news outlets to hire or retain journalists so that people, companies like Alden might actually have a motivation not to lay off their journalists. A major part of this would be antitrust exemptions that would allow news organizations to negotiate with Google and Facebook for advertising revenue, which has been, a big negative force in the finances of news. And then what's called a replanting strategy, change in tax laws that would encourage these hedge funds to consider selling their outlets to local owners.
In the meantime, what can citizens of the Allentown area expect to see if the morning call, if nothing moves forward to preserve the morning call as these various efforts are playing out, what can citizens expect to see as far as local news is concerned? And where might they go to actually find local news if the morning call can no longer provide it?
Well, I think the morning call, as I say, I mean, it's still staffed by people who are really dedicated to their community. And I would encourage the community at this point to continue to support the morning call as long as it is providing service. In the meantime, though, I would encourage the leaders of the community to begin to really seriously look at alternatives. Community foundations, philanthropic people, business people in the community. There are alternatives. We've seen this around the country in Denver, which is another absolutely devastated property of Alden. The Denver Post, which once great newspaper, has been really seriously degraded. There we've seen nonprofit news emerge supported by the community. So I would say don't give up on the morning call yet, but begin work furiously on a plan B.
Yeah. The Trump years inadvertently proved to be a boon for larger publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post, which saw digital subscriptions skyrocket while Trump was in office. Many small papers, David, did not enjoy the so-called Trump bump. What's the difference here?
Well, again, I think that speaks to where people's attention has been drawn, and the fact that so many local news organizations have been so severely degraded that they're simply not giving people enough to decide to pay. We're proud that that's a difference here in Philadelphia. We're seeing digital subscriptions to the Philadelphia Inquirer grow dramatically because we are supporting a newsroom that is giving people something of value. We've seen the same thing in Boston, Seattle, Minneapolis. I mean, there are local news success stories where the revenue mix is shifting dramatically from what historically was an advertiser based revenue model to one now that is largely subscription-based, because people are finding enough value in the newspaper, whether it's digital or in print, to subscribe to it. And the answer lies ultimately in quality. And that's what's so frustrating and frightening about Alden.
I'm sensing, though, despite this, that there's optimism about the future of local news, newspapers, amid the efforts that are going on, the philanthropic efforts to preserve local news. Where do you see the state of local newspapers, say, in 10 years?
Yeah, I am. I'm enormously optimistic, actually, about the places where we're seeing innovation, where we're seeing philanthropic support. And again, you know, we're seeing this in a variety of cities around the country, both in organizations large, like the Boston Globe and the Minneapolis Star Tribune and the Philadelphia Inquirer, and in a lot of digital startups. I'm proud to say that we at Temple and at the Klein College have been involved with seeding the local news ecosystem here. Our faculty have started news sites in Kensington and in Germantown that are small, not very labor or cost intensive news sites, but they're really serving those communities in ways that they've never been served before. We have an organization out of our college that's called the Tiny News Collective that's helping journalists start these small organizations. So I think the combination of these micro sites and hyperlocal sites combined with large philanthropically supported, subscriber supported quality organizations give us lots of reason for optimism in the long term.
Yeah, the landscape is definitely shifting, and the digital landscape is. We've got a very quick comment from Dave, because we've only got about 30 seconds left. We must all start paying for our news again. The free news available online is free because we are the product being sold, not the news. It's designed to engage us, not inform us. Pay for your news. David Boardman, 20 seconds. What do you think?
Yeah, I love you, Dave. And absolutely. I mean, that's what it all comes down to is, you know, ultimately you get what you pay for, whether you're paying through a subscription or through philanthropy or both. And obviously, I think WHYY is a good model of that. You guys do a terrific job what you do. And I believe the Inquirer is achieving the same. And hopefully we can find a similar answer in Allentown.
All right. David Boardman, Dean of the Klein College of Media and Communication at Temple University, Chair of the Lemfest Institute for Journalism. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we talk about the Philadelphia Flower Show held outside for the first time in its nearly 200-year history.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Philadelphia Flower Show is known as the oldest and largest indoor flower show in the world, but this year it broke with nearly two centuries of tradition, opening to the general public on Saturday outside at FDR Park in South Philly. The theme is fittingly habitat, nature's masterpiece, and there is a lot to observe. This year's flower show is the biggest ever, nearly double in size. So what does it take to transition this enormous undertaking of carefully curated and constructed horticultural display away from the controlled indoor environment of the convention center to the great outdoors and the unpredictability of Mother Nature? What can we expect to see from this year's designers? And if FDR Park is a success, might we see the flower show held in the open air again in years to come? Lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Sam Lemheny is Chief of Shows and Events at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. And it's great to have you with us. Welcome back, Sam.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Well, what a project. When did it become clear to you that the 2021 show is going to happen in June outside, and why at FDR Park?
So last May was really when we started in earnest to sort of think. April was sort of like, okay, can we really do this thing? And then in May, we really started thinking and looking out at the different options and ideas that we might be able to pull off in less than a year to produce this show. And it was really clear by that time that there was no way we could do an indoor show not during a pandemic when everybody's masked and social distanced and things like that at the convention center, and it was an indoor show. So we came up with the idea of let's do an outdoor show. We searched all around the city for different locations, and we had a whole evaluation that we did, and FDR Park rose to the top. It has great accessibility, right? So there's, you know, access on the major roads. 95 is right here. It's right at the corner of Broad and Patterson. Tons of parking around here with the sports complex and the sports teams down here. The Phillies, Wells Fargo, and the Eagles have all been great partners with us to try and help us make sure that traffic is going well. We had a big day yesterday with the Phillies playing and the Sixers playing at the same time while we had the flower show going on. So it was a busy day, but it was a pretty successful day. And they're used to having all this traffic down here, so that was not a bad thing. And then just the park itself, FDR Park, is such a beautiful park.
It is.
Olmsted Brothers Design Park, same folks that did Central Park up in New York City. So this is a treasure here in South Philly, and to bring the flower show here and have the backdrop of all these great majestic trees, the architecture that's down here and the layout has just really given us an opportunity to rethink the show, how we design the content, how we place out the content, and how the visitor actually sees it and experiences the show.
Well, Sam, what were some of the primary considerations or challenges in moving this show from the indoors to the outdoors? I mean, what had to change for you?
So the biggest thing that we had to do is that, you know, at the convention center, who are great partners of us for many, many years, you know, if you need electricity, you need water, you just pick up the phone and call and it's right there and you can make it happen here at the FDR Park. We had to bring all that infrastructure here and set that all up. We certainly worked with the Parks and Recs team. We did exactly, you know, everything that we could do to have things that were here, but we had to bring in all the, you know, multiple restrooms. We had to bring in all of our electricity, or most of our electricity. We had to bring in a lot of different water because, you know, with the flower show, you don't think about that, but we're all plants, and so the plants need water every single day, so we have to have a lot of water in a lot of places that they just didn't have it.
Well, and we're in a heat wave.
It wasn't designed for that.
I mean, how have you been dealing with, 90-degree heat?
So that's something that you can't plan for, right? That's not, you know, the weather is okay until it's not. So the guests have been dealing with it. We have a lot of water on site, and people are bringing their own waters, and we're trying to keep everybody hydrated and keep everybody safe. So it went from pandemic, keeping everybody safe. Now we're trying to keep everybody cool, and there's a lot of shade down here, though, so that's a good thing. So we have a lot of our eating areas are in shade underneath trees, and so you can take a seat and cool off. And in the shade, it's actually not been too bad. There's a nice little breeze down here because we are right on the lake.
I'm actually thinking also about the flower show workers. I mean, do you have an army of workers at hand in case, you know, it's 95 degrees and you've got flowers that may need to be deadheaded or watered? I mean, do you have them ready to just kind of jump in and keep those displays fresh?
Yeah, we have a lot of volunteers. We have a lot of, you know, the exhibitors themselves, the designers, have a lot of crew that can help as well, too. We have what we call we're calling them our water cubes that are placed out. So it's not something that we wanted to have placed out, but something that we had to have placed out in view of the guests so they can see. It's actually kind of fun to see sort of a little bit of behind the scenes when they're walking around the show, that we need water to keep the plants alive and keep them looking great for the visitors that are coming. So we definitely have a huge crew that comes in right after close around 7 o'clock, and we've got water trucks and tanks, and it's like a little army that descends on the show at 7 o'clock and makes sure everything is watered.
Okay, so before we get to the designers, let's talk a little bit about any, you know, COVID protocols. I mean, this is why the flower show was outside. There had been plans to cap attendance to help maintain social distancing. With the acceleration of reopening in the city, is this still the case? And what might be some protocols that the visitors might need to know about?
So the great news is that we've been working really closely with the health department all along the way. Safety of our visitors and our staff and our volunteers has obviously been our number one priority through this whole process. We've had a lot of different restrictions that we're having to move in, move out, change. Literally Wednesday before the show opens, we got our last update from the health department, which gave us all the great news that no visitors needed to wear a mask. Even staff and volunteers didn't need to wear a mask. The only people that do need to wear a mask are our food prep folks, the folks that are working food and beverage, just to have an extra layer of security there and safety there for the food and beverage production. But other than that, if you come to the show, there's no social distancing needed. We do have some limitations on attendance right now because we had to order a lot of the logistics and a lot of restrooms and things like that. But we're still working a lot of that out with the health department to make sure we can fit as many people that want to come to the show and enjoy the show in this You know, the heat's a little hot right now, but it's going to get beautiful this weekend. So we're looking forward to a big crowd this weekend.
So how is attendance? Have people found the flower show in June outside? I mean, there's been a lot of advertisement, but I mean, have they found the new location to your satisfaction?
They have, you know, in the morning when because we do still have our time tickets as part of the safety protocols that we had in place, and we couldn't lift that at all. You know, it's too, everybody has their date that they're coming, and then they either do an AM and PM. So we get a little bit of a crush in the morning and a little bit of a crush in the afternoon. But after that, it's just, you know, people can just enjoy the leisurely walk. The walk-in is shaded. It's decked out with flowers as they're walking in. And so we're trying to make this as a pleasant experience as possible till you get to the main gate and then can enjoy the show. So yeah, it's been interesting to see how that goes, but people are finding it. Parking has been, you know, a little bit of traffic in the morning when everybody kind of wants to be here first thing, cause everybody wants to see it first. And so, give us some patience, but it, you know, a lot of things are moving. The police are out there to help direct traffic, and so we're doing our best. And again, this is the first time we've done it down here, so we're learning as we go as well too. So we've made a lot of adjustments from the first weekend, and we're putting those in place every single day and observing and making sure that this experience coming down here is the best it can be for everybody.
Okay, so the theme again is Habitat, Nature's Masterpiece. Let's just look at a couple of the designers.
Sure.
Jeff Latham is a floral designer known for his bold statement, and this year he is his bold statement. Mints, rather, plural. This year, he is working with some of the architecture at FDR Park, including the Olmsted Pavilion. Tell us a little bit about what Jeff's doing.
So Jeff is, you know, he's a floral designer to the stars. I know he has a good relationship with Kim Kardashian. I think they just released a fragrance out together. So he has a lot of reach and a lot of experience, and his team is so talented. And they have transformed the Olmsted Pavilion here with these massive orange and pink floral. They almost look like ribbons that are coming out all over the entire pavilion. I don't think it's looked as good as it ever has right now. And not sure when they designed that piece, when they first built the park, they had anything to envision what he's done to transform that area. But he always likes to work very monochromatically, so he's gone stepped out of the box a little bit and has done orange and pink banners coming out of it, and they're all floral 100%, and they just look like these big arms coming out of the pavilion. So we're excited that he's here. The Four Seasons locally, we're lucky that he's here in town and can bring that to life as well. So he's been a great partner, and love the fact that he's turned this entrance, and it literally is almost right at the front entrance. When you first walk in, you can't miss it. Just look to your left and you'll be blown away. Get that camera ready. You'll want to take lots of pictures and selfies there.
And there also must be, among all of these displays, a wonderful aroma. I mean, is it more intense outside in the warm weather than it might be inside the convention center?
You know, it's being outside, I think, you know, there's roses, there's different lilies here. Like, so the aromas are a plethora of as you're walking through, and you definitely get those different smells. It's different plants this year at the flower show because we're at a different time of year. We are outdoors. So some things are a little bit different. So you have different smells this year. So you got to just come and enjoy that aroma to yourself. It's really nice.
So another one of the stars at the show this year is Wamboy Ippolito. Tell us about her. She's an award-winning designer.
Yes.
What has she brought to the flower show this year?
Well, you know, she is a great designer. She's an amazing designer, and she just happened to bring the best in show garden to this flower show. So we love Wamboy. She's been a great designer to work with this year. We were so thrilled that she won Best in Show this year, and all the designers were really impressed with her design, and I think everybody who comes to see this sort of design, the theme this year is Habitat. She really took it to heart. She was born in East Africa, and so she sort of took some inspiration from her childhood home, tried to have as many plants as she could from there, but also mixing in some plants from the Delaware Valley for lookalikes to make it feel like it's from East Africa, but plants that actually grow here. So you'll get some really good ideas from her garden to bring back home and bring a little piece of Wamboy's garden back to you. But she's been amazing, fabulous. She was so thrilled and very surprised that she won Best in Show, but she put a lot of detail and a lot of time into that garden. I watched her every day. She got a lot of the mass plantings done early, and then she just fiddled and just did all this detail work for almost four days straight. So it paid off, that's for sure.
And quickly, one more designer, Patrick Colina. His display, yes, according to the Flower Show website, uses spontaneous vegetation that rises through voids within the urban hardscape. So we're talking about the value and beauty of plants we tend to overlook here.
Yeah, definitely. He it's interesting. His garden is really loaded with a lot of different trees, a lot of different species of trees that can be used in an urban environment. So if you do live in an urban environment, this is definitely an exhibit you want to take a look at if you're interested in planting trees. And so many urban locations do need more tree cover and to help us in like global warming and cooling down some of the cities, because it is such a concrete jungle at times that the more trees that we can plant in the city, and our tree tender program knows that very well and helps as many people as possible that we do throughout the rest of the year here at PHS. But his garden definitely gives you great ideas for different larger materials that you have there. And he's helped out design. He's an amazing designer as well too. He's helped design a lot of the gardens along the High Line up in New York City. And so he's got a lot of great design sense about him. And again, this habitat theme has really inspired a lot of different people to build something that so many different habitats to look at.
Yeah. And so we're talking about habitats that might be local to the Delaware Valley, but also habitats across the globe.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, that's something that's so great about it. We have so many different designers that we are allowed to, able to have so much diversity and variety here at the show to show you, things for your garden right here, and actually just some inspiration and some great color and some great things that you might not have ever seen before, and plants that you might not have ever seen before. So it's a great mix of things.
So Sam Lumhenny, the Flower Show, of course, is usually held at the end of winter. It's such a breath of fresh air at that time of year, but... I know it's early days, but do you anticipate for 2022 moving back to the traditional spring flower show, or is there a chance you might continue the outside version?
So we haven't made that decision yet. I think, we start our planning for our flower shows well in advance, and we've actually already started planning for the show at the Convention Center in March next year. But, depending on how successful this is, how the feedback goes, our board has sort of left a door open for us to make that decision. And so we're going to have some really good conversations after the flower show, and we'll see what happens. Maybe we'll do two shows. Who knows? Maybe we'll do one in March and one in the spring or in the summer. That would be fun. My team might not like that, but I think that'd be something to think about.
Well, you, what are you hearing from visitors? Are they open about their preference at this point?
Yeah, I think a lot of our volunteers who are closest to us are telling us they're hearing so much great feedback. They love being outdoors. The heat has, dampened that a little bit, but towards the end of this week, I think people are just really going to feel great. And being outdoors, we're really seeing, because people from a pandemic standpoint have not really been outdoors a lot. They've been staying in their homes. So this is really one of the first major events that they've seen have been to with a large crowd of people. And so they're enjoying it and loving it. It's a lot of things we have to take into consideration because we are coming off of this pandemic high. I think that people want to get out and be a part of nature and be a part of the flower show. And we're a long-standing tradition. I think people were missing it. And so this is a great time for them to be here. So we are hearing a lot of positive feedback. A few things about logistics that we're correcting every day with some lines and things like that. But we're working, just let everybody know, we're working to correct those things in the moment. And the first time we've done here, so we're asking for a little bit of patience. But, I think most people here are really enjoying the show and enjoying the experience here. A lot of food and beverage here, too. So come prepared to have some nice, great food, great drinks, and enjoy that libations when you're walking around. That's the one good thing with the no mask rule now. There aren't any restrictions when eating, too. So a lot of the restaurants are opening up. So the flower show has been able to add a lot of great food and beverage experiences as well.
Yeah, I'm hearing you're planning fireworks as well. Is this the first for the flower show?
It is. Yes. I work before I came to the flower show. I worked at Disney, so fireworks have been in my blood for a long time in my career. And so coming to the convention center, you really can't do fireworks inside. So the first thing I said to my team when we moved outside is we got to think about how we can do fireworks. So during our Flowers After Hours event on Saturday the 12th, we are closing the show at 7 and then opening it back up at 8. And it is a hard ticket event, so go to the website. You can get all the ticket information. But we're having a great dance party that we've been doing as a last 5 years tradition at the show, After Hours. Folks can come. We do drink sampling. We do great food, and we have great entertainment for dancing and having a great time in the show after dark.
Right.
And then to close the night out, we will have fireworks.
Okay, Sam, thank you so much. Good luck with the flower show. It runs through June 13th, right?
Absolutely. June 13th, okay. Sunday. So we can't wait to see everybody down here.
All right. Sam Lemhenny is Chief of Shows and Events at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is Paige Murray Bessler. Thanks, Paige. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Be well.